Those of the staff, management, or ownership of WGCH Radio.
Good morning, Grants listeners. This is my inaugural radio show. This is Fotis Poliakis, and we will discuss, and the name of the show, starting today, is A Peek at the World from Greenwich, according to Fotis. So, every Saturday, regularly, from 9 to 10, we will grab our coffee, and we will look and discuss current affairs, world current affairs, from the perspective of Greenwich, and obviously from my own research and knowledge about the subjects I will bring up, so that we can all have a better understanding of the world and more educated understanding of the world. But first, as a prologue, let me tell you a little bit about me. As you may have detected, I have a slight accent. And no, I'm not from Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn. But I assure you that you're mostly listening funny. So I call Greenwich my home since the late 80s, when by happenstance, after visiting a friend in Stanford, I drove through all Greenwich and ended up at Touch Point. As a sailor, it was love at the first sight. I immediately signed up to join a crew from Old Greenwich Yacht Club, and it was an immense pleasure to be back on open water. I will be giving you some bits and pieces of my background as my story unfolds in each broadcast. First and foremost, I'm an immigrant. Legal, that is. Yep. I came from Greece in 1981 to attend engineering school. I went to Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey, where in 1870, Stevens was the first institution in the U.S. to award a mechanical engineering degree. And it was one of the hardest things I did. I thought it was very easy to get in, but extremely hard to get out. So, but the early and persistent siren calls, they were calling the U.S. my Ithaca, my new home. So I fell under the spell of America, a utopia in my then young eyes. So I never left permanently the shores of this great country, which is a source of pride and accomplishment to me as a naturalized American citizen. And I have my two children. One of my son is serving in U.S. Army, very proud for what he is doing. And I have volunteered, and I still continue to volunteer in many respects, in civic issues and other affairs here in Greenwich. Coming from Greece, or more technically speaking, it's called Hellas, H-E-L-L-A-S. It's a rather heavy burden. My ancestors' long and glorious history and their substantial contribution to what we refer to as the Western civilization is etched and tattooed in our foreheads and chests as we carry it around, lest we do anything to degrade it. So I have striven to live under the Judeo-Christian values embedded in me from birth, from my parents and my extended family, and the heavy burden of the Hellenic history and culture. It's like carrying the aspis, the steel shield of the Hellenic warrior marching to another battle to defend family, religion, and land. For such a lofty objective, I use whatever I have at my disposal, like culture, experience, education, business and social status, family, friends. First, I use all of that to understand the complex world we live in, and then to engage and participate in its functioning, because from the Hellenic standards, a citizen must participate, not should, not could, not would, must participate in the functioning of the society. So voting, for example, it's a must. It's not if, it's not optional. If you want your voice heard, you show up. My background, as I just described, provides a lens to see and understand my surroundings and explain the impact situations exert on me. So I am an amateur Hellene philosopher and an international affairs student. The ancient Hellenes would not have survived and thrived for the past four millennia if they did not master the art and science of diplomacy and domestic and international affairs. You see, the state or polis, P-O-L-I-S, such as Acropolis, that they created was the early form of a modern state as we know it today. Later, the Treaty of Westphalia in 1648, they finally, the Western European countries then, after ending a very long and protracted war, agreed to define what a sovereign state may look like and act like, and also the definitions of its territorial claims and boundaries. So when we talk about geopolitics, geoeconomics, world affairs, it's the relationships that bound all of these states with each other that is what we're talking about. So the general theme of my work here on Saturday mornings is international affairs, discussion on geopolitical terms and geoeconomic issues that ensue from such a study. How I got involved in that, it's a short story, but interesting. In 2016, I had the distinct pleasure to meet the late Arizona Senator John McCain in a very intimate meeting at Linda McMahon's house here in Greenwich. The senator had just returned from a trip in Russia where he met Putin. He was very negative and aggressive against Putin, and Putin in particular, not just Russia. That was following the 2014 Crimea illegal annexation. The senator then held a pivotal position in the powerful Armed Services Committee and was very influential in Congress. And he was a thorn on the side of the Obama administration, especially after the lame reaction to the Crimea debacle, i.e., not enough resistance and objection to taking over Crimea. The setting in the House was very intimate and personal, and I was able to spend at least half an hour with speaking directly with a senator on geostrategic issues. He listened, he asked me questions, and apparently impressed by my knowledge as a regular citizen, suggested that I formalize my education on the subject of international affairs by attending a global graduate school, and then potentially join the McCain Institute, which he had found in the University of Arizona, or at his staff in D.C. So I was impressed. And I did have some thoughts about getting involved in politics, but this was really a kick in the butt. There was motivation. So here I am in my mid-50s, thinking about going back to school, and it can only happen full-time. So you can imagine, after GMATs, trips to schools, think tanks, conferences, meeting with people involved in international affairs, making friends. I applied to several schools, Ivy Leagues and others, like Johns Hopkins, Georgetown, Brown, Columbia, Princeton, George Washington. But ultimately, I decided to stay put in New York and not disrupt my life any further. So I was fortunate enough to have closed a sale of a company where I was the CEO and investor, which gave me the freedom to take some time off. Well, 2 years was a long time off, but somehow I managed it. Columbia University offered me the best package in the situation, not money, but it was close enough. It was obviously top-rated school. And I joined the class of 2019, at the School of International and Public Affairs, or SIPA, S-I-P-A. To my surprise, I was twice the average age of the cohort, and a minority conservative, middle-aged white male in a sea of liberal young students, and most importantly, the esteemed faculty. The contrasts were stark. I remember arguing with 26-year-olds who have not earned a penny in their life about economies and forms of government. But they were all based on their education, but not practical life experiences. And by that time, I have been around the block a couple of times. So 4 semesters of interesting subjects, taught by past and current practitioners of diplomacy and national security. It was an amazing experience. Political government employees usually go to academia in the off years of their preferred party. So as I was entering Colombia, the Trump administration was in place. So the resistance was at full swing. I was marked as a not one of ours. So I had to argue and be the opposite side in many conversations. But nevertheless, I devoured the knowledge and the opportunity to participate in events where the actual actors devising and applying policy for the U.S. government were speaking and engaging us in the flesh. I met numerous leading experts in international affairs that they were coming by, from CEOs to secretaries of state, the many of the secretaries in charge of the three-letter agencies in D.C. So what are we talking about when we refer to global or international affairs? What is geoeconomics or geopolitics? Well, international affairs is a dynamic relationship of states with each other. Like we have relationships with individuals, ourselves. So politics starts when you have three people in the same room. One tends to agree with the other on some subjects, and they form a relationship. That's politics. You're trying to do something as a form of appeasing or appeasing someone. So the dynamic relationship of each other, it could be either with states, or sovereign states, individual states, or a collection of states under a common theme like the European Union, dealing with other groups or individual states themselves. But there are other international actors which have no claims or control land, like ISIS, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, the Taliban when they started in their formative years. They're still state actors or non-state actors that they interact with each other. But we need to take into account everyone, because even a small group like Al-Qaeda caused a tremendous upheaval in the global order starting in September 11, or before 1988 in the bombings in Nairobi. So there are two major camps in recognizing those relationships. There's a certain basis of how they view the world and how they perceive the dynamics of the relationships. These two camps are the realists, capital R, and the liberals, with a capital L. The realists see the world as a constant power struggle for state power and mostly mercantilistic behavior. I will do something to gain something, to retain the state power and maintain the hegemony that I might have. Examples of that behavior and that mindset is Dr. Kissinger. He has been around for a long time. He still is in his late 90s. Still, he still moves the needle when he speaks in international affairs. On the other side are the liberals, again with capital L, whose primary motivation is the ideology of the human element in the relationships, like human rights, freedom, democracy. That's their motivation to reach out and touch someone across the globe, is to improve the human relations and the human existence. So many U.S. presidents have acted on either way. And right now, for example, Biden is very liberal, capital L, in the foreign affairs relations that we have, where Trump was more mercantilistic and Bush, 43, was a combination. The geoeconomics, oh, by the way, although I will tell you about international affairs, etc., I will definitely tell you what my opinion is. Since I own the microphone, and you get to listen to me, you can disagree. And I'm sure in the future we will have call-ins and participants here. I will invite a lot of my friends from around the world to express their opinion. But you will listen to my opinion, and then I will explain to you why I stand on that. My view of the world is more of a realistic view with a lot of liberal participation, but it's mostly realistic view. So the geoeconomics and geopolitical expressions refer to the physical geographical location of a state and the effects it has on trade, economy, and political power. For example, we have a sandbox and several children playing in it. One of them may be closer to all the toys. That is a geopolitical power to that child, unbeknownst to him or her, because they are closest and they control some of the toys. So the same thing happens in the arrangement of states around the globe. The originally Greek words emanating from the word yis, which means land, earth, and oikonomia, economy, and polis, which is the city-state, an organized physical development. For example, America is blessed with a physical location. We have an unparalleled location to any state in the world. We sing from sea to shining sea. We're bordered and protected by two vast oceans and a gulf in the south, but which also provide the best means of trade and freedom, as well as our seawalls for any enterprising invaders. It's not surprising that we haven't had any invaders to our land. We are blessed also with good neighbors, good neighborhood. Maybe not always as good, especially in the South with the Mexican cartels, but we haven't had any war here since the Civil War. So we have most abundant physical resources. Think about the rivers and lakes, the subterranean water, minerals, forests, valleys, mountains, animal life. We have fossil fuel, fossil energy, sunlight. Most importantly, they're all in a temperate climate, hospitable to human existence and development. Such a physical state, that is, when developed with a human capital and technology, it will definitely become a powerhouse and a hegemon in the region. And we have that. We have proven that. We're it. Compare now this geostrategic position with that of Russia, for example. Its mass land is nearly four times as large, spans 9-8 time zones to four of ours, but is mostly not accessible for human development with a very low occupancy density and indefensible borders. Siberia, think of the steppes of Siberia. They produce a lot of oil there, but very few people live. So the land is not as usable as ours is, and is not as defensible. And that's one of the reasons that we discuss in some other issues, episodes of our broadcast, why Russia acts the way it is. And Catherine the Great said once that the best defense is to get more land and increase that, what they call the defensive depth, which became very useful to them twice, once in the Napoleonic Wars and another time during Second World War with the invasion by Germans. So if we look at another example, Australia, on the other hand, can be as geoeconomically powerful as the U.S., it's surrounded by water. It's a huge amount of land, as big as the U.S., but only 25 million people. So it lacks the human density to take advantage of the land's attributes. The economic production seen from the perspective of the gross domestic product is a function of the amount of human capital engaged in the economy. There is a proportionality to it. And they have not enough of it. The United Kingdom, although a tiny mass land island, it used its position as an island to rule the high seas for nearly two centuries, maybe more, yielding geoeconomic and geopolitical power globally. Obviously, they colonized a lot of other lands, Africa, islands, India. So it was a reach out and grab land for them that they didn't have and imported the products and the product of all the production from these lands back to their land. So they created their own geoeconomic power. Think of the Rock of Gibraltar, for example, as the ultimate geopolitical location to check and oversee the flow of vast shipping in and out of the Western Mediterranean Sea. Now, the reverse, though, is not true. For example, Egypt, in the northeastern corner of Africa, although a reasonably large country, populous country, the most populous in the Middle East, it does not have a strong economy, but it yields a substantial geopolitical power by its unilateral control of Suez Canal in the eastern entry to the Mediterranean Sea. Think of the 1956 and again the 1973-74 Middle East wars where Egypt closed the canal. It caused a political stir and made Aristotle Onassis the richest man in the world when his oversized crude oil tankers went around the Cape of Good Hope in South Africa to circumvent the closure. Think about last year when a disabled ship ran aground in the Red Sea in the canal. It caused a tremendous impact on the economies that they were dependent on Asia, Europe, and even Asia, America container traffic. So a country like Egypt has a good control of some portion of the economic strength that other countries have because they trade. So another example would be Turkey. It's the only country that straddles Europe and Asia. Very small European part, by the way. My hometown is very close to the European portion of the Turkish border. And it belongs to the G20 Club of Economies, which is the top 20 economies in the world. But its strength lies in its geostrategic position, location, because it controls the Dardanelles, the access to the Black Sea that gives access to Russia, Ukraine, Bulgaria, Romania, Moldova, Georgia, Azerbaijan, and others in the region, even out to the Caspian Sea from there. So Turkey yields disproportional political influence in the region based on the access to bordering states and bodies of water. Singapore, a tiny island of Malaysia, has more political power in the Southeast Asia than countries 10 times its size. So size matters, location matters more in geopolitics. Geoeconomics is a different story. So any given state has an array of tools in its disposal to protect state power. In the industry, the parlance is statecraft. Those statecraft items can be economy, military, energy, technology, finance, legal, human capital, information, intelligence, media, culture. So you can imagine any of those items that I just, powers of state that I just mentioned, can be used and weaponized. And they have been, and they are, and they will continue to be. Those are the powers that, each state creates and uses for its own benefit, but also to influence the world. Think about the U.S. Our economy is the foundation of our strength. Our democratic system, our freedom to exercise our religion, to have our own business, to be capitalists. It is the foundation and our strength. From there, a lot of other things come, like the military strength. Without $780 billion a year of our annual military budget, we wouldn't be as strong as we are around the globe. We're the only country in the world that have the ability within 18 hours to deploy a very strong force of military power around the world. Russia cannot do it. They just reached out to Syria. That was it. With one aircraft carrier, we have 12. China, they're building the second aircraft carrier. Diesel-based, oil. How long it will last with one? If you have one, you have nothing. But they're building, and they may come up to maybe two or three. But we have been using aircraft carriers, for example, since 1943. We're experts at it. We're the best. And we can project power. The Navy has a call sign called Global Powered for Good. And that's what we are. We do that. So the military is very important in projection of power. But it has been used and abused sometimes. And that's not always, or it shouldn't always be, the tip of the spear. It should come, as Theodore Roosevelt said, walk calmly with a stick. Use the stick sparingly. Lately, we have used it a little too much, and we need to rethink about the other elements of our statecraft. The next one that comes to mind is energy. Energy is huge. Energy is our culture, is our civilization. Without energy, nothing happens. Imagine the latest generation if their iPhone is not charged. What would they do? Energy, lights, heat, power. That's how we became the superpower we are. Everything emanates from energy. Energy is everywhere. We transform energy. We change energy from one to the other. We take fossil fuels from under the earth with chemical energy in them. And with combustion, we make them heat energy to mechanical energy to friction. So energy is transformed, is not lost. It has a lot of frictional losses, but we mostly use it efficiently. So without energy, it is a very difficult way of sustaining an economy. Look at Germany. Russia has monopolized the sale of fossil fuels to the European continent, almost 55% in gas and 40-some percent in oil. And now that went to zero. That transformation from that source to another source has been in huge acceleration the last year since the war started in Ukraine. And Germany is the example of what not to do when you put all your eggs in one basket. Now you need to diversify not only forms of energy, but sources of energy. So having energy independence and energy security is a statecraft. Very strong. I would argue as strong as the military one. Then technology. You know, here in the United States, we're trying to keep China away from our technology. Oh, they keep stealing it. But we're trying to keep them away because technology is the investment of many, many years of funds and human capital to develop something, to make things more efficient, faster, better, stronger. And technology, it's something that it can be used and improved for the betterment of the human race. And it prolongs our lives, longevity. So technology is a major tool, and you can distribute it like the vaccines, or you can restrict it. Another one is finance. The United States is blessed with a dollar. The dollar is the common denominator in 80% of the world. Oil is traded in dollars. Although the euro is strong, but it's a small portion of the presence of the dollar in the world. And that happened following World War I to World War II, when the prominence of the U.S. was accepted and the dollar became the legal tender. And states around the world, including China, including our adversaries, they're buying our treasury bills and treasury notes. Then we have legal. The legal aspect of a statecraft, it's not well known. I will give you some examples of that. The FBI, it put a couple of the terrorists on a wanted list. But they were not in the United States. They were somewhere else around the world. With legal means, we were able to locate them, reach out and grab them, and bring them back under U.S. law. Not that law of that country that they were there, under U.S. law. So that has not been done by any other ones. This is one of our own making because we have the strength to do it. The human capital is another statecraft. We have, we allow immigration, legal, hopefully, that we attract people. We are the only country that people trample over themselves to and drown to cross rivers and lakes and climb over fences to come to the United States. What other country has that problem? We're attracting the humans to come over to the United States to partake of what we have here. Another statecraft would be information. Information and intelligence. It's interchangeable, I would say. What do we know about others? How do we know? How do we get them? How do we get that information? How do we use it? When do we use it? So we were talking about you know, Russia interfering with our elections. We've been interfering with elections around the world for years. Think about the 70s, Latin America or Europe. So our information and intelligence has been honed very well in experience over centuries. So we have our culture, we have our media. Think about the influence that Hollywood has on the world. They look at our movies and they see the way, you know, we act, we dress, we eat, we shop, we entertain ourselves. That's our culture, and that has great impact around the world. And of course, media is how we transfer all of that knowledge that we have. How do we put it in the airwaves and in print and media? So that's a quick explanation of the statecraft. And to the great degree, it is developed. And they create, either individually or in combination, perceived power in the form of influence, positive or negative. And also, they intimidate or coerce. That we have the power to use them in the ways that we deem appropriate for our purposes. So taken together in combination can be an irresistible force against smaller and weaker states, which lack the ability to counter. So we see the persistent balance of power struggles among neighboring states or clusters of states under a common cause against the real or perceived hegemon or aggressor. In addition, states that lack a certain element of power, military, for example, will gravitate towards alliances and treaties that cover the eventuality of common defense. An ascending power, that is a state that is growing stronger, causes consternation to the incumbent powers, which look for ways to counter and maintain the status quo. In ancient Greece, after the Persian Wars in 490 and 480 BC, where a combined force of the Greek city-states repelled the invading Persians for the second time in a generation, Athens rose to prominence politically and culturally and established its golden age. That's when they built the Parthenon, and they wrote philosophy, and they wrote poems and tragedies and theaters. All of that happened in the 5th century, the Golden Age. The Spartans, a competing city-state with a sizable alliance of like-minded states, very militant, very austere, felt threatened and displaced as a hegemonic military power by the mostly soft Athenian powers, which was based on economic and cultural superiority. That, in turn, had attracted other states to Athens' sphere of influence. The threat of being displaced led to a protracted and destructive conflict, the Peloponnesian Wars, as described by the historian Thucydides, which weakened both states and eventually resulted in their demise by the rise of another state from the north, Macedonia, the Greek state, with Philip II and his son Alexander the Great, and the rest is history. This perceived inevitability of conflict in a unipolar hegemony was later described by Graham Allison, a Harvard professor of government, as the Thucydidean trap. I'm trying to say that very, very, very fast. I would rather say Thucydides' trap, be correctly. So in a multipolar world, that is, there are factions and counterfactions, many circles of influence and spheres of influence, the Thucydides' trap proved as potent. The polarity can be a commonality or division in economies, culture, religion, military strength, which leads to clustering by common cause to treaties and alliances. Following the creation of the German state in 1871, for example, in the North and Central Europe, the other powers of England, France, Russia took notice of the new land power ascending especially one with great maritime ambitions. And as a defensive step, they established alliances between them in case of real or perceived aggression by the Kaiser. Germany took similar diplomatic action with the Austro-Hungarian Empire in Central Europe. So if a party in an alliance was threatened and took action, the others needed to come to their rescue individually. But the dissimilarities in the power of each state in their statecraft were stark. The British were an undisputed naval power with little land army, where the French were the opposite. The Austro-Hungarians held together a mix of dissimilar states under their economic umbrella with no effective military strength. The Russians had huge landmass with an undeveloped economy and a weak military. The German state had the best combination of powers in industrial strength, military might, and most importantly, their willingness to use it. In simple terms, a spat between the weakest states in the opposing alliances, namely Russia and Austro-Hungary, after the assassination of the Archduke Ferdinand in Serbia, started a series of unraveling actions based on corresponding treaty obligations. But without being directly affected, the powers sleepwalked into the largest and most destructive world conflict in August 1914. The casus belli, or the cause of war, in diplomatic parlance, was the mutual obligation to each other. The sequel to World War I, 25 years later, the cause was the grievances left unchecked from the first conflict. The result of the first global war was the eclipse of the Pax Britannica and its replacement by the Pax Americana in a bipolar global order for the next 40 years during the Cold War. So Thucydides may have been right. Maybe. It was a conflict, the Cold War, arranged on the differences on the form of government, but buttressed by military strength. The U.S. was leading the pact with the free and democratic states, where the Soviet Union was under communism and the spread of it. Fortunately, the struggle did not lead to another world war, but rather in proxy fights peppered in Europe, Asia, and Africa. Think about Vietnam. And eventually ending by the economic capitulation of the Soviet Union by the heavy burden of the inefficient social state and militarism. In other words, a sustainable economy and the culture around it trumps any other statecraft in the long term. The future subjects of our discussion will evolve around current affairs, and we'll dig into historical perspectives. You will think of the biggest white elephant in any international affairs conference room today is the ascending power of the Chinese Communist state from ours, American perspective. Not all share our perspective. Like the Europeans are split, unfortunately. There should have been, but they are. Nothing else comes close to the most important relationship that will define the 21st century, and that's the U.S. relationship with China. Do we call China a superpower? No. It's a peer, but not a superpower. It doesn't have the military strength to reach out and touch anything yet, other than a small or a rather sizable base in Djibouti, very close to our base in Djibouti, potentially controlling the entry to the Red Sea. Maybe they're building another port in Pakistan, but they're not there yet. I don't believe that there will be a hot conflict to prove which world order system will prevail. The unipolar, which is Pax Americana, or the bipolar one, which is the Chinese influence in Asia versus the Western influence with America. At the end, it will be which system of governance leads the respective economic system to prominence with the highest human happiness. That's key. Because without the sustainable environment to satisfy and exceed human needs, the rest are ephemeral states that will rise and fall with demagoguery. Now, China is a huge subject, and we will visit it many times over. But we will also intersperse a lot of other subjects, like the conflict in Ukraine, the weaponization of fossil fuel energy. We will talk about Russia, why they act the way they act, who are their friends, who's helping, who is not helping. We will ask extensive questions about energy and the impact of civilization economies. Energy is a substantial factor in many geopolitical conflicts. We will look at different locations around the globe. Latin America. We have great countries, great potential, great people. And I remember reading that FDR insisted that Brazil be included as a large country after World War II when they were building the UN, Brazil to be included in the Security Council in lieu of other countries. And that did not happen. Latin America, for some reason, is not coming up as strong as they should have. They have the potential. They have the landmass. They have the people. So we will look at, I will invite some Brazilian friends, some Argentinians, to tell us a little bit about their perspective. And we will look at that as well. Then we will talk about Europe, obviously. Big, big part of us. When we talk about Europe, we can't not start with Germany, a big industrial export economy. Why and how did he get trapped in where it is right now? Very smart people. They have withstood and they overcame many obstacles following the Second World War. How did they get to be where they are now, running around to build plants that take our LNG, liquefied natural gas, as their primary source of energy? How do they not see the need for nuclear energy? Do you know that Germany is among the leading countries in the world with the application of solar panels? For those who know Germany and geography, sun is not always shining. And the solar panels worked most effectively with sun. Think about California. So political prevalence of choices make those bad decisions last a long time. And being an economy that exports mostly, it will be hurt in the production and the execution of their industrial plan and policy without sufficient energy, not just to sustain what they have, but to grow. Because Germany is the economic power of Europe, of the EU. On the other hand, France, not the economic power of the EU, for a long time has solved the issue of energy with almost 75% of its capacity being generated by nuclear power plants. Why are we so afraid of nuclear energy? I think the stigma comes in from the original use of that technology in weapons. Well, that's behind us. Do you know that about 250 people have died, directly or indirectly, from nuclear pollution that escaped from commercial operations of nuclear energy. That's it. A lot more people died every year in traffic accidents. I shouldn't say accidents. They're not accidents. They're crashes. Or the safest form of transportation, flying. But that energy can give us, especially fusion, the latest form that we can achieve, not fission, which produces some of their nuclear waste that we need to put away. But even that, it will save a lot more than what we're doing now, going gung-ho on changing from fossil fuels overnight. I'm not saying no, we shouldn't. We should, but not immediately and not overnight. And the market proves that we need to give it time for those economies to adjust to the new realities. India, this month, will surpass China in the most populous state in the world. Do you think that its energy needs will subside, or they will switch to purely environmental, clean energy? They will not. Neither will China. So their powers that they use and the energy that they take from Russia is a political tool. And we will be talking about that in the near future, because that is a big subject, how the economies sustain themselves. It's through energy, human capital, and technology. Well, and obviously we will talk about Asia. Since I mentioned China, I equate China with Asia a lot, and we do have a lot of friends in Asia. And the Quad that we have arrangement with Australia, Korea, South Korea, Japan, India will help us a lot to counter the Chinese ascendancy, peaceful, that is. So I thank you all for listening to me in my first broadcast. I was a little nervous. I don't know if you can tell. But now I feel a little better. And we will continue next Saturday at 9 o'clock. Thank you for listening.
This is your community radio station, serving Lower Fairfield County and Westchester. 1490 WGCH in Greenwich.
USA News, I'm Jeremy Scott. Tornadoes across the South are blamed for at least 9 deaths in Alabama and Georgia. Officials fear the death toll could rise as search and rescue efforts continue. Alabama Governor Kay Ivey praised the people of her state as they deal with such devastation.
Typical of the values that we Alabamians have.